Now we both kinda like it. Now we both kinda know that if we're ever gonna make it, we just need to let go.
You're listening to the Crosscutting Concerns podcast. I'm your host, Matt Groves. Please visit the site at crosscuttingconcerns.com, where you can subscribe, browse the archives, contact me, read show notes, and leave a comment.
I'm recording this podcast on May 31st, 2017 at IndieCode in Indianapolis, Indiana. My guest today is a software engineer, psychology nerd, and mental health consumer, Arthur Dollar. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about retrospectives today. How long would you say you've been working on Agile teams?
I've been working on Agile teams since around 2010, I would say, because there was a conversion from a company that I was working at, switched over to primarily Agile stuff. So since then, I've worked in stuff that's, you know, strict Scrum. I've worked in stuff that's Kanban. Worked in things that are more loose than that, more dynamic teams with high functioning throughput, things like that. So,
I mean, strictly speaking, retrospectives aren't laid out in the Agile manifesto, but they are generally a big part of Agile teams. Do you find them to be a valuable experience?
Absolutely. I mean, part of human experience is recognizing what's happened and then trying to get better. That's a huge part of becoming a better developer and becoming a better person, honestly. So retrospectives, whether they're formalized or not, are an essential part of the software development process. Unfortunately, there are some problems with them, and certainly with how some people approach them.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about some of the problems with retrospectives, but you mentioned software already. Can you be more specific about what kind of software projects you've worked on in the past?
I have worked on stuff from as wide-ranging and interesting as a project that was done for casino data analysis, where we tried to correlate persons based on things like social security number, things like that. So casinos wind up with problems for their player cards, where people will forget them, they'll come in every year. Things like an entire retirement community in Florida puts everybody on a bus and goes all the way up to Atlantic City every year, and then every year they all get new cards. So you can't correlate those activities with each other because it looks to the system like it's different people. And our system was designed to kind of link into these systems and go, okay, this person has the same name and they're the same age, same social security number, it's probably the same person. And then start going from there and linking out relations with these people and going, well, these people have the same last name and they've lived at the same place at one point, so they're probably related. So if one of them is the dealer and one of them is actually playing the game, that's probably a bad sign. Well, at least if you're in Atlantic City, because the rules in Atlantic City say you can't do that. So.
Okay.
And then I've worked on stuff as boring as reporting stuff or banking software. So wide range of technologies, Java, JavaScript, C#, recently doing some Unity, done some PHP, and like I've done a lot of stuff. So.
Okay, so Java and C#. So take note, listeners, not everybody on the show is a C# developer only.
It's true.
Let's talk about retrospectives some more. What are some of the problems you've observed with retrospectives?
Some people do retrospectives very rote, in the sense that, oh, we have to have a retrospective because that's what Scrum says we should have. So let's have a retrospective and then we'll sit around and talk about them. I've actually been in retrospectives where people were like, well, what are the problems that we had? What are things we should learn from? And we're like, okay, here's some stuff that happened and we should probably not do that again. And everybody nodded sagely and wanted to move on to the next topic. And I was like, we're not going to talk about like how to not do that again here now? And they were like, no, I thought we were done with that topic. It's like, no, we need to actually discuss how are we not going to do this again. So aside from structural problems like that, or something that is, you know, more endemic to the pointy-haired boss management style of things, we have a problem with retrospectives in that as human beings, we function with a couple different modes. Am I allowed to plug stuff now?
Go right ahead. Plug away.
There's a fantastic book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, who's a psychologist who's won the Nobel Prize for Economics, which is not a thing that happens very often. He's the father of behavioral economics. He's a really nice guy, a really smart guy. He wrote the book to kind of describe that we have two systems in the brain that we can think about them like that. It's not really how it works. We have lots of different systems that interoperate and act each other, and there's no like physical locality to a lot of it even. But it's easier to think about, say, we have this system that operates in what we call slow thinking, or what he calls slow thinking, which is system two. It's this cognitive, linear, correlated, logical thought process. That's when we think about, like, what's 42 times 768? The thing that answers that question, that's system two. On the other hand, we have system one. And system one is our fast thinking brain for stuff that we evolved to need quick answers for, like, I'm in threat scenario, I'm being chased by a tiger, where should I go? Tree or lake? It really doesn't help to have system two come in and go, well, let's weigh the pros and cons, because by the time you get to the third pro, you've been eaten by the tiger. That system one's job is to make those quick decisions, those snap judgments. That's our intuition. All of the ideas you have come to you when in the shower, that's your system one, has been chewing on these things, this process called incubation that comes back with these answers. When you start dealing with these two systems, you have to realize that they don't actually talk to each other. We can't consciously interact with system one. I've kind of likened it to, you have the presidential suite in the hotel of your brain, but there's a vast amount of information going on and activity going on that you don't have access to. Now, you can do a lot of things in the brain. You can call down and make a lot of things happen in the kitchen if you order food service. But you can't go ask the people who are making food service in the kitchen, hey, did you spit in that? Because you can't. You just don't have access. They won't let you in the kitchen.
And they probably lie anyway.
That's also true. Well, and that's system one can and will lie to you in a sense. So, but this interplay between the two, with that lack of communication, can lead to hiccups. And these hiccups are things that we call cognitive biases. Cognitive biases are kind of this codified list of things that we know that the brain doesn't work quite the right way on. So a really good example is if you have a bat and a ball, and together they cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? And if you don't do the math, you just sit there and listen to whatever your intuition tells you, it's going to tell you 10 cents, which is wrong. The bat's $1.05 and the ball is 5 cents. And that makes the math work out. But that system one leaping into the four and saying, no, this is the answer. That's the intuition. That's where these cognitive biases start to come from, when we just rubber stamp things coming from our intuition, from our system one, which we tend to do because as part of system one's job is to save us energy. It takes these shortcuts, these heuristics. Its job is to kind of maintain this model of our world. As a result of that, that's how it saves these energy. We tend to rely on it far too much in situations where it's really no good. Kahneman explains this in 400 pages.
I'm still trying to parse the $1.10 bat and ball problem, but I'll work on that later when I get a paper and pen. So cognitive biases, there are probably a lot of different types. We could go into them if we had a longer podcast.
There are 117 on the Wikipedia list.
Okay, let's start with one and we'll see how... No, I'm just kidding. But you've seen a lot of these biases in action. You've been to a lot of retrospectives. What sort of solutions would you propose to help address these biases?
A really good one is to remember that we tend to tell each other, or tell ourselves rather, a story about ourselves. We tend to say things like, hey, this person is my friend, they're my ally. We tend to talk about conflict in terms of narratives, like this person's our enemy or a nemesis. And I've literally heard that word used inside of retrospectives, at which point everybody kind of turned and was like, really, dude? That mentality of us telling ourselves a story is really important, because we have to realize that we're not the only ones doing that. Every other human is doing the exact same thing. Almost no human casts themselves as the villain in their own story. We're all the hero. Even Bernie Madoff, he just went to jail for 125 years for the vast Ponzi scheme that he did. But they did a bunch of interviews recently that came out on a really good series on Audible, which they didn't pay me to say that. It's just where that is.
Call me Audible.
Please, me too. They went ahead and asked him, and it comes out through the course of these interviews that he views himself as a pawn of his four largest investors, who he thinks knew that he was doing illegal things because the return on investment that they were demanding was far too high to get via any legal means. So they had to know. Was he right? Doesn't matter. He was doing an illegal thing and he went to jail for 125 years. The point is that he doesn't view himself as a villain. He was doing illegal things. He was ripping people off, ruining people's lives, but he thinks that he was manipulated. So the object is to go actually talk to people. If you can't talk to them, think about it. What do they value? What do they think their extenuating circumstances are? There's another cognitive bias called the fundamental attribution error, which says that I tend to think that my actions are because of external circumstances, because that's what the situation demands. On the other hand, we tend to think that everybody else's actions are because of their inherent attributes. Like, for instance, oh, I didn't prepare for this talk because I had medical problems and it was really hard and I had all this work to do and then everything, you know, exhausted. And it rained and that made me sad, so I couldn't work on it. On the other hand, all of the other presenters are lazy and irresponsible. That kind of duality, that it's really hypocrisy in a strict sense, but we don't think about it as such. We just kind of naturally do it. And we tend to do it even more with people who are in what are called outgroups, groups that we're not part of. So if we're a developer, that would be like QA or the UX team or managers. We tend to view these people even more as products of their inherent attributes and not their external circumstances. So talking to these people, finding out what they value, why they acted the way they did, if you already have a conflict with them, and then taking that and folding it back and saying, okay, how can we come to a common goal? And how can I understand what your goals are and what your values are and what you feel your circumstances are? Maybe you're always getting in my way because you feel I'm going the wrong way, because you value something differently and you see stopping me as a valid goal, a valuable goal even. As a result of that, we have these conflicts that are completely unnecessary. I know that sounds trite. Just sit down and talk with people, right? But honestly, if you can sit down and talk with them in that context of understanding where they're coming from, what their goals are, and at least, even if you don't necessarily agree with that goal, that value, and you don't necessarily agree with why they did what they did, at least you took the time to understand it. And that's really valuable. There is a thing that people say before a retrospective sometimes, where about assuming that everybody in the retrospective, everybody during this sprint did their best work. You know, kind of a pledge to assume up front that that is true. And that's exactly what you're trying to do. Is say, okay, I'm assuming that everybody here did what they could. They know what we're here to do. We have a common goal as a team. Our goal here was to deliver a piece of good working software. And if somebody couldn't do that, there were probably circumstances behind it. Finding out what that was is very important. You also see that in postmortems when you do things like five whys, a thing where you go through and ask why five different times. So you ask why, you get an answer, and then you repeat, why did that happen? It's a way kind of a drilling down to deal with this complex causality where, you know, we can't necessarily see or comprehend what caused something. So we try to use this thing to drill down. But a lot of teams will stop at a person. They'll go, well, it was Bob. Bob didn't do his job. And then, great, now you found the cause. The cause was Bob. Except, why didn't Bob do his job? Is it that Bob is lazy? Because that's the answer you want to tell yourself because of the fundamental attribution error. But maybe Bob isn't lazy. Maybe Bob felt like this other thing was more important. He was getting feedback from somewhere else that said, no, your other goal is more important, so you shouldn't do this part of your job. And that caused this failure. That will help you highlight the systemic problems inside of your organization, inside of your culture, that are leading to these problems. Because if you replace Bob with somebody else, you say, Bob's an idiot, we're firing Bob, and you put Janet in that position, Janet will eventually face the same conflict. She may not make the same decision as Bob, and so you think the problem is solved, but the conflict is still there, and she has to deal with it. So, other things you can do. I know that's a huge, long answer for the start. Other things you can do are avoiding things like hindsight bias, which causes you to say, well, I should have known the answer to that. And you can do that just by recording things. There's also another bias that's related to that called outcome bias, where we judge the quality of a decision based on the outcome. That was a good decision because something good happened. Whereas that's not really always true. We don't know the outcome of the decisions that we make.
So you mentioned recording things.
Yeah.
What kind of things are you talking about and how are we recording them?
Ideally, what you're looking for is you definitely want to record action items. You want to record why you made decisions, why you decided those were the action items. Those are really important because then you can look back and say, well, this is what frame of mind we were in when we made that decision. And we look back and say, was it a mistake? Knowing now what we know then, probably because we know it now. But can we look back, put ourselves in that frame of mind and say, could we have made a better decision? Was there information we didn't know? Was there information we could have spent time to get? If you can answer that question in the positive, you can say, yeah, actually, we should have done this other development spike first before we tried to convert everything over. Then that means you can reevaluate that decision and learn from it. Not necessarily chastising yourself for making that decision in the past, but saying, all right, going forward, we're going to do something else different. It helps to have as many people as you can actually taking notes. Like a dedicated note taker is good, but the more people you get, the more perspectives you're going to get, the more incidental stuff they're going to write down, because not everybody writes everything down. So those different perspectives on the decision are also important, because sometimes you get a thing where people will have different perspectives on why a decision was made. Like, no, I thought we made that decision because of A. No, we actually made it because of B, I thought. Now you don't even know why you made that decision, so it makes it really hard to actually recognize what you could have done differently to come out with a different outcome.
I want to talk about a lot more of these solutions because they're really great, but I want to keep this relatively short, so
yeah.
I have a couple more things I want to ask you really quickly. So I've served in a couple of different Agile teams in the past with various different approaches, retrospectives. Sometimes it's been, one big retrospective that takes all day. It only happens maybe once or twice a year. And I've been at other teams where it's a retrospective happens every sprint, maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I've noticed, retrospectives sometimes devolve into not so much a celebration of what went right, but rather a obsession about what went wrong. You can only talk about, only pat yourself on the back so much and say, what a great job we did on X, Y, and Z. Now let's spend the rest of the meeting talking about what went really, really wrong and what do we do about it. So sometimes I feel that there's sort of an emotional draining there because we worked really hard, we accomplished some great things, but we're really focusing on the negative things only. Is that a problem that you've seen, and what are some approaches to dealing with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a problem. I have seen teams that try and do what they tend to call the poop sandwich. They will sandwich that bad part of the retrospective with good feedback, like that good pat on the back at either end. So you kind of get the goodness, and then you get that, and then you get the bad. I'm not a fan of that approach because I feel, for starters, like it makes people upset when you start talking about the good things you did because they're waiting for the middle part of that sandwich. And I've seen too many managers use it in basically that way. That was a really good job you did, Art. I mean, you could have done better on like X, Y, and Z and this other thing, but still, congrats. And it's like the rest of it, like the outer parts just wash away. That's not even worthwhile. I think it's a frame of mind thing. It's not about talking about what we did wrong. I've seen a lot of retros try to cash it as what we could do better. And keeping that frame of mind is important because cashing it in terms of this was not something we could have done better then because we didn't know back then. I mean, this goes into that keeping the frame of mind of where you were when you made that decision. Why did we do that? Oh, well, we did that because maybe we weren't thinking about it. Well, now we're thinking about it and we're never going to do that again. That's probably a bad way to put it, but we're going to try hard not to do it again. Telling yourself you're never going to do it again just means you're going to beat yourself up when it inevitably happens. The framing in that way is, I think, a really important part of how you are presenting that information, because you can, and I've had retros where we did spend almost the entire time talking about the happy stuff because somebody came out and was with a glowing thing about other people in the retro who people had done in the sprint. And as a result, everybody else was kind of uncomfortable to kind of move into that bad part of the retro that we talk about. And I think that is also a part. Like, why is it? It is emotionally draining to talk about the things that we have done. It also helps to have trust in your team at that point. Trust that everybody else is in on that goal. Trust that everybody else is really just trying to deliver a better product. That helps reduce the emotional drain of that portion. I also find it helps not to have all day retros because that really does help. The more you can chunk that out into shorter periods of time, the less you are likely to have something that is very emotionally draining to talk about. It's kind of the analog to the fail fast, right? You turn around and you're analyzing your failures relatively quickly rather than letting them stew into something larger and then holding a retro only once or twice a year. I do know teams that do that and they make it work for them. I mean, that's the trick answer to the question, right? It's what is best? Well, it's whatever your team likes. Whatever works for your team. But
so shout out to Jim Holmes. There is no best practice, right? There's only better practice.
Absolutely.
Next thing I wanted to mention, the last thing I wanted to mention was not really a question, more of a comment. There's a great podcast based on the Freakonomics books, the Freakonomics podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And they did an episode recently talking about headwinds and tailwinds. Let's say as cyclists,
mm-hmm.
you pedal against the headwinds and you struggle with them. And you're like, why am I always stuck against headwinds? And then when a tailwind comes along and pushes you along for a little bit, you're really grateful at first, but then you sort of get used to it and
yep.
you no longer appreciate that positive thing that's happening. And so you have a tendency to overvalue and overestimate the amount of headwinds that are facing you
yep.
versus other people.
There's actually a bias called change bias that's that exact same thing. We tend to remember the effort to actually make a change as harder than it actually was. Partially because of that, because the things that stick out to us are those things that were difficult, that were negative. If it was an easy thing to do, it doesn't stick in our head. We forget it. We're like, oh, that was a breeze. On to the next thing. I think that's an interesting part of the retro. If you are talking about your successes, emphasize those. Not just we did a good job, but this was good. We should remember that it was good so we don't get a bad idea in our heads of how much effort we actually had to take or how bad our team actually is. Like, if the project can feel really bad, if all you remember are these negative things from inside each of the retros.
So I'll put a link to that in the show notes at crosscuttingconcerns.com. I would love to have you on the show again to talk about more of this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want to put you on the spot to say yes right now, but I'm just going to say that personally, I've enjoyed this and I want to learn more about it.
Okay.
But is there anything else at this point you'd like to plug or any contact info for listeners?
Yeah. So first off, Daniel Kahneman's book, absolutely. Go get that. It's Thinking Fast and Slow. It's 400 pages, but it's the fastest 400 pages I've ever read. There are some pretty good podcasts on things like cognitive biases and this kind of social psychology stuff. Hidden Brain by Shankar Vedantam. His book and then his podcast, which is on NPR, are both really good. There's You Are Not So Smart by David McCraney. His book, both of them, and his podcast are also really good. Let's see. My contact info is at Arthur Dohler or arthurdohler@gmail.com. I welcome people talking about it.
My guest today has been Arthur Dohler. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
This has been the Cross-Cutting Concerns podcast, produced and recorded by Matt Groves, 2017. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you downloaded this podcast. For show notes, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com. This episode is recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. Hosting for this podcast was made possible in part by Microsoft. It was recorded and mixed with the help of Audacity, Skype, and Camtasia Recorder. The theme music is by The Dirty Truckers. You can buy the music on Amazon or iTunes. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on a future episode, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com to submit your name and idea.